Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Wall Street can expect another bailout if the financial system again fails. The words of President Obama in a speech delivered from Federal Hall on Wall Street today, telling industry titans, "Hear my words. We will not go back to the days of reckless behavior and unchecked excess." The president said that he was determined to push forward with regulation of financial markets to prevent a repeat crisis. And he addressed those who think his proposals inject too much government into the private sector.
The lack of sensible rules of the road, so often opposed by those who claim to speak for the free market, ironically led to a rescue far more intrusive than anything any of us, Democratic or Republican, progressive or conservative, would have ever proposed or predicted.
The president's speech came on the first anniversary of the collapse of banking giant Lehman Brothers, the collapse that eventually triggered the government bailout. Benjamin Appelman is a financial reporter for The Washington Post. First of all, your overall thoughts about the speech?
This was not a speech that was meant to introduce a lot of new ideas. The president largely reiterated the proposal that he had delivered in June for reform of the nation's financial regulations. Part of the point here today was political. The president wanted to command the news on the first anniversary of a really bad event and to make sure that Americans were reminded of his efforts to prevent another version of that event. And part of this was symbolic. The president went to Wall Street. Washington is increasingly in Wall Street's business, and this is a manifestation of that trend.
Well, and we're wondering, too, if it's a reaction to reports that Wall Street has gone back to the same practices and exotic financial instruments that brought it down a year ago. The president had been asking for an agency whose sole purpose would be to oversee the trading of exotic financial products, something Wall Street hates. Did he specifically speak about that?
He talked about the idea of regulating what are called derivatives, complicated financial products that, as you say, have largely been allowed to trade without supervision. He talked about other key elements, protecting consumers more effectively, regulating large financial institutions more aggressively. The whole plan was laid out. It's the same plan he's been talking about for several months. The obstacle he faces is that it hasn't made a lot of progress so far. It's sort of been sitting there in the House and Senate, getting chewed on, getting picked over. And he now needs to see if he can sort of convince Congress to pick up that work and push it through.
Two of the other agencies the president calling for, the Consumer Financial Protection Agency to work with credit card companies and banks, the third agency to wind down the giant companies that are failing. But you mentioned that it's sort of been picked over the summer. How much has the debate over health care reform put this on the back burner?
It's interesting, you know, it's a good metaphor because there really are multiple burners on the stove. This is a city that has the capacity to deal with more than one thing at a time. I think there's too much of a sense in some circles that because healthcare is being discussed, financial reform is not. There are different committees working on both sets of issues. This has been marinating all summer. People have been working on it. There are drafts of legislation circulating. I don't know that its fate is too intertwined with the fate of the healthcare legislation.
Well, and we just mentioned sort of the broad brush strokes. Supporters of reform want requirements that banks have more cash on hand. They want an international agency to share the loss when huge international companies like AIG fail. You know, they want a dismantling of the system now wherein credit rating agencies like Standard & Poor's are paid by the same people that they rate. So, you know, what is the sense that some of those details, those shards, might see the light of day when some of the broad brush hasn't even gotten there?
It's likely that there's sort of two answers. The first is obviously there are some incredibly large problems with the way our financial system is regulated. You just touched on a couple of the big ones. It's a really long list. And the intention on Capitol Hill is to produce a piece of legislation, a single bill that deals with this entire laundry list of issues. And in some sense, some of the smaller ones are probably easier. If they can reach agreement on the big ones, some of the smaller ones will just come along for the ride. But you're right that a lot of these things are incredibly complicated in their own right. They have people on both sides of these issues, and there hasn't even been a discussion about them yet. So this goal of implementing financial reform by the end of the year, Seems to a lot of people incredibly ambitious and perhaps a little bit unrealistic.
Especially since health care reform has the same pledge. Well, President Obama also wants to give the Federal Reserve more oversight power to implement policies to keep companies from getting too big. But it was the government during the Bush administration that encouraged the sale of Bear Stearns to J.P. Morgan or Merrill Lynch to Bank of America to save Bear Stearns and Merrill Lynch. And now we have these, you know, just a handful of banks. I think three, J.P. Morgan, Wells Fargo, and Bank of America, have three out of every $10 deposited in the U.S. It feels as if, you know, the idea of too big to fail has gotten bigger.
It absolutely has. The government has played a central role in making these institutions even larger. When you talk to senior officials about this, they're almost pained by it. They know that a problem that existed before the financial crisis has, in essence, been exacerbated by the financial crisis. These too-big-to-fail banks have gotten even bigger, and they are now trying to find ways of reining them in. But there's no question that in attempting to keep us from an economic abyss, one sort of bitter medicine piece of that was that these institutions got larger.
Benjamin Applebaum, financial reporter for The Washington Post, commenting on President Obama's speech on Wall Street today. Benjamin, thank you so much as usual.
My pleasure.
Cancer patients on chemotherapy regularly use the term chemo brain to describe how they're feeling, a mental fog that can be very serious, say if loss of focus means loss of your job. But some doctors have denied its very existence. Well, now there are studies of everything from ginseng to prescription medication meant for sleep disorders to help lift what more and more conclude is a very real thing. Dr. Dan Silverman, associate professor at UCLA, has co-authored one of a couple of books out on the subject. His is called Your Brain After Chemo, A Practical Guide to Lifting the Fog and Getting Back to Your Focus. Dr. Silverman joins us from Los Angeles. Welcome.
Thank you. Hi, Robin.
So how do doctors largely respond when patients complain that they have this thing called chemo brain?
A lot of times what they find is that their oncologist isn't particularly tuned in to hearing about those kind of complaints, either feels that they may be relatively trivial compared to the much larger issue of treating the cancer for the purpose of improving survival, or that they may not even believe that those things that the patient is complaining about really have anything to do with the cancer or its treatment.
Or, as you write, they may be symptoms of menopause. A lot of women say they just get a pat on the back and a wink, you know. Or they're told that it's depression, and doctors might try to medicate it away. But patients say it's real, it's physical, and they're on blogs everywhere talking about it. Tell us what they say it feels like.
The most common complaints are, first of all, things that we call executive function, that is not being able to maintain your focus of concentration, not being able to multitask, not being able to make decisions as readily and not being as confident of the decisions that are being made. Another major area of problems have to do with memory and with the ability to speak fluently, either not being able to think of the right word or come up with the thoughts and put them together in a way that you can articulate them as fluidly as before, or not being able to remember things altogether that previously would have been easy to remember.
Well, and I'm sure a lot of people listening would have the same response we had when we were reading the book. You know, gee, I have that on a daily basis. You know, a lot of people are feeling like they're forgetting their keys, but you tell extreme stories of a man who puts his groceries into the car and then drives away without his wife.
And that's a very good point, is that a lot of the things that are included in what people complain about are not unique in the sense that you have to have post-chemo brain in order to have had those symptoms. But what's really key for each individual person is how they are compared to how they used to be. And a lot of people who are very high functioning to begin with, and this is true whether we're talking about post-chemo brain or whether we're talking about early Alzheimer's disease, they can lose a lot of their functional abilities cognitively before they would fall outside the normal range for someone of their age and educational status, say.
Is it worse if different drugs are used in chemotherapy?
There are different classes of drugs that are used to treat the same condition. So, for example, with breast cancer, which is one of the most common types of cancer that have been studied with respect to post-chemo brain, there are four major classes of what we call cytotoxic chemotherapies, meaning that they're designed to actually kill cells. And the problem is that although they can kill tumor cells, they're not entirely indiscriminate, so they can kill a lot of the normal tissues in our bodies as well. And then another major class of therapy agents are anti-hormonal agents, agents that block either estrogens from working where they usually would work, because some of the cancers, and this is true of a substantial portion of breast cancers and also ovarian cancers, have estrogen receptors where the estrogen acts like a growth factor in itself. So one thing we've found is that people who have a combination of the two, that they get some of the cytotoxic chemotherapy, plus they get some anti-estrogen like tamoxifen, have the worst impairments. That is, they do not as well cognitively as people who just get one or the other. And we've also done brain imaging studies to show that their brains are affected in ways that brains aren't affected in people who just get one or the other.
Well, so I guess it raises a troubling question. You quote a study from the Yale School of Medicine where 75% of the respondents over the age of 60 said that they would turn down treatment, they wouldn't want chemotherapy, if they knew it was going to severely impair their mental function. You tell stories of people whose mental function has been severely impaired by chemotherapy. So are you saying that patients should be informed so that maybe they can have the choice of not choosing something that might save their lives?
Every therapy that a doctor prescribes or that a patient may self-administer has certain benefits and certain risks. And I think what needs to be done is have a fully informed consent, that is, that the patients need to be honestly made aware of what the possible risks are and how likely those are. And they're often told about a number of them. They're told that their hair might fall out, and they're told that they may become immunosuppressed and get infections. But they often are not told anything about the possible effects that the therapies might have on their brain function. And they need to be told the benefits of having that therapy versus not having that therapy, or having a combination of therapies versus having just, you know, one therapy. And I think it's important to emphasize that very few people have severe impairment as a result of having had cancer or therapy for cancer, unless the cancer and the therapies for it are specifically directed to the brain, if the cancer occurs in the brain and there's radiation given to the brain and something like that. But on the other hand, it may not take more than a relatively subtle deficit to make a big difference in somebody's quality of life. So if somebody is a teacher, an actor who's improvisational, has to think on his feet, a relatively subtle defect may put them outside of their ability to do that as well and may diminish not only their actual abilities but their confidence to perform. And so we do have examples in the book, for example, of a radiologist who ironically was somebody who was a specialist in mammography and was more or less forced out by his partners of his practice because they were concerned, and he was concerned, that he may be making mistakes and missing cancers in his patients.
That's Dr. Dan Silverman. His book is Your Brain After Chemo. In it, he also talks about why some cancer patients on chemotherapy may feel reduced mental capacity. A 2005 study from the Netherlands concluded that chemotherapy may affect neurons and keep some brain cells from talking to others. Studies on mice from the University of Rochester link chemotherapy to brain cell death. But anti-cancer drugs aren't thought to cross the blood-brain barrier and go into the brain. So another theory is that chemotherapy may trigger a molecule called the cytokine in our immune systems, and then cytokines do have the ability to cross into the brain where they might become toxic. In any event, chemo brain is real. So what can patients do to fight the fog? Well, some are taking part in trials of prescription drugs to help them. One woman does a daily chemo check. If she can't answer two questions, say what's her social security number or her kids' names, she won't go out. So we want to know, does this talk of chemo brain stigmatize cancer patients? We'll have more with Dr. Silverman. And later today, a hero in war, but his father says he'd rather his late son was called a humanitarian. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Dr. Dan Silverman of UCLA. His book, Your Brain After Chemo, validates what many cancer patients have long said, that chemotherapy causes brain changes, for some, for years after treatment. But Dr. Silverman, do you worry that in telling their stories, you're creating, you know, a stigma that cancer survivors can't function?
If anything, it substantially diminishes the stigma, because currently people feel, who aren't very familiar with this concept, that there's something just wrong with them, or that they're just not strong enough or to rise above the stresses they're going through. And it's a huge relief to a lot of people to find that it is, quote unquote, a thing, that there is this real phenomenon that's been well studied, that we can see changes in people's brain structurally, we can see changes in people's brain with functional brain imaging. There's a number of animal studies that show directly that chemotherapy not only affects the ability of the animals to perform, say, in a maze, but also affects the brain structure and function as well.
And now that chemo brain is being acknowledged, can it be treated? We know that some doctors were prescribing antidepressant medications for people with chemo brain, but is that the right tact, or are there medications that can specifically treat this?
Well, certainly if someone has depression, they should be treated for it, because depression all by itself can lead to cognitive impairment. And for the part of the cognitive impairment that's still there once the depression has been treated as well as it can be is the part that needs to be dealt with other specific strategies. And other kinds of medications for which there is evidence that may be helpful for at least a substantial portion of people, for the most part, have so far fallen in the stimulant categories. Things like Ritalin, or a close relative of Ritalin that's been tested specifically in the context of people who have post-chemo brain. And another drug that's also in the stimulant category is modafinil, or Provigil, that's used for people who have sleep problems, or they have a disturbed sleep-wake cycle. It can help get them back on track, and also has a couple of papers to indicate that some people have the post-chemo brain syndrome are benefited by that as well.
Well, you have a lot of advice for people who do have chemo brain. Develop routines, use calendars, don't use post-it notes, keep a notebook instead, use pill boxes, don't guess if you've taken your pills, literally rehearse before you go into a meeting, use timers in the kitchen. But tell us a little bit about foods. Are there really foods that can lessen the effects of chemo brain?
Well, there's certainly foods that one should make sure they're getting specifically enough of so that the brain has all the resources that it needs in order to be able to repair itself. For example, proteins are really important, because amino acids serve as the building blocks for the most important neurotransmitters in our brain, the chemicals that allow one brain cell to communicate with the next brain cell. And if you're not getting enough protein to supply those amino acids, then you can't make those, and you can't make enough of the enzymes that you need to be able to synthesize neurotransmitters and other things. And people would think, well, the brain must be so highly regulated after all these hundreds of thousands of years of evolution that it doesn't matter too much what you eat on a day-to-day basis. And one of the big surprises actually to emerge from research that was done, a lot of it at MIT in the 70s and 80s, was that, in fact, it can make a big difference, that what your brain sees on a day-to-day basis in terms of the amino acids that are present influences how much neurotransmitter of each kind that you actually are able to make.
You also say drink daily from the three basic beverage groups, milk, coffee, and alcohol. Now, we don't want to rush to clarify. The coffee is for the caffeine stimulant. But when you say alcohol, you give statistics, it's got to be wine, not liquor. And if you're not someone who should be drinking alcohol, switch to grape juice?
So I guess I should hit both of those points. First of all, on the coffee, it isn't probably just the caffeine. Well, certainly caffeine all by itself has a lot of important benefits, the ones that we've known about for decades, you know, having the ability to increase alertness. But also in more recent times, we're finding that there are direct benefits in terms of anti-inflammatory and antioxidant properties. In fact, some of the recent research in the Alzheimer's field is showing that caffeine and coffee compounds are having the ability to reduce amyloid plaque, which is the kind of protein that accumulates in patients' brains, even reversing some of the plaque that's already been deposited. As far as alcohol goes, again, we've known since kind of the 70s, 80s, that there's likely a benefit in terms of overall cardiovascular health and in terms of longevity by virtue of having small amounts of alcohol. But on top of that, there's, again, specific reasons to think that alcohol and the constituents in it, particularly the constituents that we find in red wine, have more direct benefits in the brain in terms of antioxidant, anti-inflammatory properties as well.
Is chemo brain progressive like Alzheimer's or dementia? Or is it the opposite? Does it ultimately go away?
It's not progressive like Alzheimer's in the sense that by the time people are a few months out from their last dose of chemotherapy, if they are affected by the post-chemo brain syndrome, they generally don't get worse from there. And a lot of people do, as you say, get better or even return to their normal level of cognitive ability. But not everybody does, and maybe somewhere around a fourth or so of those people who are initially affected remain affected for the long term. And when I say long term, I mean we've studied people who are 5 to 10 years out from their last dose of chemotherapy and not only still report cognitive impairment and still have impairment that the neuropsychologist can measure through their testing, but in fact have altered brain metabolism that we can see with brain PET scanning, for example.
I want to be clear. Are there some cancer survivors who've gone through chemotherapy who don't get chemo brain?
That's absolutely the case. And we think that probably the majority of patients, somewhere around the order of about 3/4 of them, have some kinds of cognitive effects at some point during their chemotherapy. So what we're really concerned about in terms of these studies I've been talking about are the lingering effects, the effects that people still experience once their chemotherapy is done.
That's Dr. Dan Silverman, head of the Neuronuclear Imaging Section at UCLA Medical Center. He and medical writer Adele Davison co-authored Your Brain After Chemo, A Practical Guide to Lifting the Fog and Getting Back Your Focus. Dr. Silverman, we started by saying that doctors don't acknowledge what cancer patients have long said that they feel. How have cancer patients responded to this acknowledgement of it?
We've gotten overwhelmingly positive response from people who just, in fact, having the condition been given a name or just being aware of how common it is and how biologically based it is has been almost therapeutic in itself. It's been something that people can take away and say, no, I'm not crazy after all. Or maybe I am crazy, but this is something I'm not crazy about.
Dr. Silverman, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Robin.
Quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, AIDS and hunger, leading killers in Africa. But ironically, in rising from poverty, the continent is coming down with Western illnesses like obesity. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, the U.S. Open. Look out. Smashed rackets, threats about tennis balls, bad words. And John McEnroe is in the booth, not on the court. After the news, Here and Now. Angelo Camerata served his first beer just minutes after Prohibition ended in 1933. He served his last Saturday night. That's right, except for a 30-month stint in the Army during World War II, Angelo has tended the bar in his family's Camerata's Cafe for the last 77 years, the longest-serving bartender in the world, according to the Guinness Book of World Records. He finally decided to retire at 95, in part to be with his wife, she's 92, but also because of his son's health, they're 59 and 60. Angelo joins us from his home in Pittsburgh. So first of all, you've had your first full day of retirement, that was Sunday. How's retired life treating you?
Well, Sundays has always been a retired day. They put it there, but today it was a pleasure, not that big hustle bustle, because not bad. Look after my wife and look after the business, and that was a little bit hard to do.
Yeah. So what did you do Saturday night? Do you remember the last beer that you poured?
The last beer that I poured was a bottle of Iron City. In fact, a couple of them, and I drew some Iron City light draft beer.
Well, in fact, you sold your first bottle of beer for 10 cents. You waited for that first minute after Prohibition ended. It was at your dad's then grocery store before it was a bar. You were 19. Do you remember what that beer was?
That beer was Fort Pitt, no longer in existence.
Yeah. And we should say, you know, bars have gotten pretty fancy. They're serving things I don't know what they are, mojitos and cosmopolitans. Do you mix up those kinds of drinks?
No, I am not a mixologist. I am strictly a neighborhood bartender, a neighborhood bar. Shot in a beer place with sandwiches, no dinners. Mm. Our customers are all mostly neighbors and a very friendly bar.
Well, you know, it occurs to us then that you have, I'm imagining you've served probably generations from the same family.
I can think of 5 or 6 families that I have served. 4 generations.
4 generations. Does that make it tougher or easier when you have to cut somebody off?
Well, I may have a surprise for you. It's been several years before we finally had to cut someone off. Our customers here are not boozers. They know what we expect of them, and we have no problems. I had a man come in here that I had to bar 10 years ago. Good person. We'll need sober, of course. He told me, you see that sign outside this building? This is a bar. When I come in this place, I can do anything I want, and I can say anything I want because I'm in a bar. Oh, I said, you are not the owner of this bar. You pay attention to me or you're out. And I had barred him before.
Are you sure? You say, you know, you want to spend more time with your wife, who's 92. One of your sons had a heart attack at 59.
Yes, he did.
And so there was concern about that. So the bar's been sold. Are you sure you're not going to miss it a little bit?
No, I won't. I will miss the customers. I have to say that. But my wife is in good health, but it's her ankles, the walking and so, you know, and she needs a little help here and there. The 25th of this month, in 10 days or so, we will celebrate our 71st wedding anniversary.
Wow, congratulations. Well, you know, Angelo, we thought that the story here was the longevity of your work behind the bar and perhaps a love story with a family cafe. But it turns out the love story is you and your wife. What's her name?
Marietta.
And we wish you a wonderful retirement together.
I thank you much. And I was saying, I had a sister lived on Magazine Street.
Up here in the Cambridge area. Mm-hmm.
She just passed away.
Aww.
She was 101 years old.
Oh, I remember
and
that.
And I wonder if I could mention her name, whether it could be Frances Geratina. Lived on Magazine Street since 1932.
Some longevity there in the Camerata family. Angelo, thank you so much, and enjoy your retirement.
Thank you much.
Angelo Camerata, he just retired at the age of 95 after 77 years on the job at Camerata Cafe there in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts on anything on the program. You just go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us to send an email, or you can scroll down and leave a comment right there on the homepage. Back in 30 seconds, Here and Now. The family of a Massachusetts soldier killed in Afghanistan travels to Washington this week to receive the Medal of Honor he earned on a remote ridge in Afghanistan 3 years ago. On that day in 2006, Army Sergeant Jared Monty and his men were ambushed. Sergeant Monty took cover, but one of his men was wounded, lying out in the open. Sergeant Monty tried to rescue him and was killed. His three attempts to save Private Brian Bradbury were futile, as was a later attempt by others. When Private Bradbury and a medic were being hoisted up to a helicopter, the winch broke, and they both fell to their deaths. Sergeant Jared Monty will receive the Medal of Honor posthumously at the White House this Thursday. The medal is the nation's highest honor for military bravery. Paul Monty is Jared's father. He joins us from his home in Raynham, Massachusetts. And, Paul, of course, we are so sorry for your loss. And your son sounded like quite a guy.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that. Yeah, he was a magnificent human being.
In fact, the fellow soldier who nominated him for this award said that on that day on that ridge, it was the bravest thing he'd ever seen a soldier do. Can you remind us what your son did that day? Is it hard? I'm sorry.
It is. It's the same thing you have to go over again and again and again, and
yeah.
It gets real difficult, but... The major push that was supposed to go into the valley ended up being delayed by 3 days. So they were running out of food and water and called for a resupply. The resupply came in and the drop was made in a position where it sort of marked where they were. They were fired upon. And as you said, one of his comrades was hit and down. Jared decided to go out and try to save him. He tried the first time. He got within 4 feet of Private Bradbury when he was driven back by very heavy fire. He took cover behind a low stone wall and calling in to get the artillery fire on their position, basically. Then handed off the headphones and again tried to get Bradbury. Didn't get very far the second time. The fire from the enemy was so intense. He asked his men to give him cover fire, which they did, and he tried a third time and only made it a few feet before he was hit by a rocket-propelled grenade and killed.
Yeah. When you heard this terrible story, in addition to it being just terrible, is that also the son you know? Would he just say, I'm going to do this, three times.
Absolutely. No question about it. Jared was the kind of kid that never gave up, ever, ever. It wasn't in his vocabulary. And he couldn't have lived with himself if he hadn't done that.
Your thoughts when we understand it was President Obama himself who called you.
Yes, it was.
To tell you this, that your son would be getting the Medal of Honor. Your thoughts?
Fitting. Not just for that act on the mountain, but for his entire military career, the things that he had done, the many lives that he saved that were never recorded. They're not in the annals of the military. They were reported to me by those he saved and by their parents. For the people he touched around the world, whether it was in South Korea or Kosovo or Afghanistan, for the selfless acts that he performed throughout his entire military career, giving up his leave so others could go and be with their families on the holidays. So, fitting.
We know Jared's mom, Janet, will be there. Jared has a sister?
Yes, sister too. Nicole, older sister, three years older.
Mm-hmm. And
and a younger brother, Timothy.
Uh-huh. And we're getting the feeling that as honored as you are, it rubs an old wound.
Oh, it certainly does. It's extremely bittersweet. It's I would much rather have my son here than anything in the entire world. There was nothing anyone could give me, not $1 billion, not a castle, not anything. I want my son back, and I know I'll never have that.
Well, you mentioned that he had touched so many lives. We just received John Krakauer's new book about Pat Tillman, the football player turned soldier who was also killed by friendly fire in Afghanistan. And it's dedicated to your son.
John spent 5 weeks with Jared in Afghanistan, and they became very good friends. And he was really broken up when he heard about Jared's death.
So he seems to have impacted so many people. And I guess, just one last question. Forgive me, by the way, if this is inappropriate. But as you well know, the debate over Afghanistan has really escalated. President Obama is expected to consider a request from General McChrystal to send more troops there. The debate is whether or not to send more troops or actually cut back. Do you have an opinion on that, or do you think that Jared did?
Jared did what he thought was best for the country and the world. He didn't question his orders. Well, I can't say that either, because he did. If he thought they were wrong, he did question them. If someone told him, you know, to do something and he knew it wouldn't be safe for his soldiers, he would speak up about it. That was one thing about him. Jared wanted to bring peace to the world. He knew he couldn't do it himself. You know, nobody can. But he knew that he could be one cog in helping to bring peace to the world. And certainly chasing down bin Laden in Afghanistan, which is the reason he went there the first time, was a good thing. As far as Afghanistan today, I believe the administration made huge mistakes after 9/11. Not the current administration, mind you, but the Bush administration putting our soldiers' effort into Iraq, where there were no weapons of mass destruction. Didn't seem to make sense when bin Laden went to Afghanistan, and the guys there, including my son, did not have the proper equipment, they didn't have the proper training, they didn't have the proper soldiers. Mistakes are made.
Yeah. Well, Paul, you're headed to Washington to accept the Congressional Medal of Honor for your son, Sergeant Jared Monty. Only the sixth given out since the war in Afghanistan began 8 years ago. You know, and we heard you say you'd much rather have your son. But maybe congratulations. It's just a terrible word, but that's an honor.
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am, it is. But I want my son remembered for the humanitarian that he was. I do not want him remembered for the G.I. Joe, the Rambo, the soldier with a rifle in his arms, you know, killing people. That wasn't him. He was a humanitarian, and that's the way I want him remembered.
Paul, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. The story of how Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in Major League Baseball, the first black player, is a well-known milestone in American history. But if you mention the name Wataru Misaka, you might get a puzzled look. But Watt, as he's been known since childhood, crossed a similar barrier in the 1940s. He was the first non-white player in professional basketball. His story is now the subject of an award-winning documentary. The BBC's Matthew Wells reports.
There's the ball to Wawa Jones. He shoots, hits the rim, bounce back out again, and Misaka steals it away. That little fellow's all over the court. Misaka to Farron.
The sound of an extraordinary year in the life of Watt Misaka. Born and bred in the craggy western state of Utah, he became the darling of Madison Square Garden in 1947, the cathedral of basketball here in New York City. While many of his fellow Japanese-Americans were forced to sell everything they couldn't carry and live in internment camps during World War II, he studied engineering and became a star player. Until this year, his achievement went largely unnoticed. But now the 85-year-old's enjoying the limelight once again and fresh acclaim as a racial pioneer.
I graduated from high school in 1941, and then the war started a few months after that.
I mean, you yourself were not locked up, but did you? Were you aware of a kind of growing resentment?
Oh, yes. You'd run into that on the streets almost every day. I chose to kind of ignore that as much as I could, and the school kind of insulated me from a lot of that racial tension and hatred. And
I mean, did you feel fully accepted on the basketball court despite the war going on at the same time?
I couldn't say 100%, but, as far as my own teammates were concerned, it was 100%.
Fresh from winning one national championship with the University of Utah at Madison Square Garden, Misaka entered the war in its final days as part of U.S. military intelligence and found himself near the city of Hiroshima just weeks after its atomic devastation.
It was horrifying, to say the least. You know, we had no idea what an atomic bomb was. In questioning the people, we were questioning them about the morale, but we could also see the effects that the atom bomb had on the city and on the population and on the survivors.
I mean, how did Japanese civilians react to you, a Japanese-American?
They're very polite, as they always are. They kind of treat us with kid gloves.
He was not only drafted by the New York Knickerbockers, he was drafted in the first round.
A new documentary about Misaka's extraordinary life is making inroads at film festivals around the world. Well, I'm here inside the modern-day Madison Square Garden building with filmmakers Christine Toy Johnson and Bruce Johnson. What made you want to make this film in the first place?
We thought, why haven't we ever heard about this guy? You know, what's his story? And so when we found out that he was the first person of color to be drafted into the NBA, we thought, what? I think as Asian Americans, we share an experience of being always looked at as perpetual foreigners. And at a time when the U.S. was at war with Japan, it was heightened 100 times fold.
It's all the more extraordinary that Watt Misaka broke out and was playing here at Madison Square Garden a few years later.
What was extraordinary to me about that is that when we first interviewed Watt, I just assumed that everywhere he went that he was getting racial jibes thrown at him. But this was the one place that he played away from home that just really embraced him. Madison Square Garden really got behind him.
Yeah, you know, New Yorkers are, they're known for their supporting of the downtrodden and the underdog. I had a lot of fans.
Why do you think you were such a big hit with the crowd?
I was little, and so I was even more an underdog. And I hustled. That was my style of playing, to run around and hustle and disrupt the opposition and that sort of thing. And that determination and all was very appealing to the New York spirit.
Spears' shot is no good, and down under the boards. Little Misaka digs it up. He's surrounded by blue shirts, but he gets rid of the ball.
Misaka played only three games for the Knicks before being let go. They loved him here in New York, but playing away in the provinces, his race was almost certainly a liability. He still wonders what might have been.
My Japanese upbringing came into effect there. You know, they have that attitude of, I don't know if you've heard the term, but they say shikata ga nai. That means that it can't be helped, and so you make the best of it and go on your way. I've got a nice family, and I'm not rich, but I'm happy.
You're rich in memories.
Yeah, that's correct.
After refusing an offer to play for the famous Harlem Globetrotters, he went home to Utah, took up bowling and golf, and lived contentedly as an engineer. He returned here to Manhattan for the first time in 62 years just a few weeks ago, an honoured guest of the Knicks. The highlight was seeing that 1947 team plaque.
Well, all I saw on there was my name. It happened to be the one on the bottom, but that was the one that I saw first, and I really didn't look to see any others.
Thanks to the film, Watt has finally been admitted to basketball's Hall of Fame. Christine Toy Johnson says the recognition is helping a new generation of Japanese Americans.
That's been one of the most wonderful things to see when we've shown the film to younger generations of people who are still battling racism, maybe in a different way, but learning from him about how to turn the other cheek and still hold your ground and be proud of who you are, but not let it get the best of you. And like Watt says, he just wanted to play basketball.
That report from the BBC's Matthew Wells. Well, Belgium's Kim Clijsters became the first mother since 1980 to win a Grand Slam tennis title this past weekend, her daughter Jada toddling around the court as Kim accepted her U.S. Open trophy. And today, new father, Switzerland's Roger Federer, tries for his sixth straight U.S. Open. But overshadowing both may be Serena Williams' profanity-laden outburst in the semifinals Saturday night. There's even talk that she may be suspended from playing in next year's U.S. Open. John Wertheim, senior writer for Sports Illustrated, is in Flushing Meadows and joins us. John, Williams threw her racket. Later at match point for her opponent, a lineswoman cited Williams for a foot fault on her serve, and Williams threatened to, shall we say, lend that lineswoman a tennis ball to put in her mouth. First of all, what are people saying about the footfall call that sparked all of this? The replays looked really close.
The call was a little sketchy, especially at that point in the match. But still, in no way does that excuse or justify just an outrageous reaction by Serena.
But earlier in the matches, in an earlier round, a Russian player said the F word right to the camera and also smashed her racket. So what was the line that Serena Williams crossed?
Well, I don't think it was the profanity so much as the threat and the violence. She also approached this woman and had raised her racket, as bad as McEnroe was. And keep in mind, he was suspended and fined. I don't ever recall him threatening bodily harm like that.
Right. She said afterwards that she handled the situation poorly, but she's playing doubles today with her sister. Was there a move to pull her from that? And what might happen in the future?
Well, that's the big question. I mean, she was fined $10,000, which, you know, frankly, to her is mall money. I mean, she'll win $500,000 at this event alone. Personally, I don't think she should be suspended, but, you know, I'm not sure a $10,000 fine is an ideal punishment either.
Right. Well, let's talk about the big men's final today. We've all seen the statistic. It's been more than 2,000 days since Roger Federer lost a U.S. Open tennis match. Do you think he'll continue that streak today against Argentine Juan Martín Del Potro?
I do, but it wouldn't surprise me if Del Potro won. He's been playing fantastic. The difference is he's never been in a Grand Slam final, actually playing a match when the trophy's there on the corner of the court.
And it might also depend on whether Del Potro has something called a tweener. That's the shot that Roger Federer hit between his legs back to the net yesterday, and he still made it in.
Just a sensational shot, but it also says a lot about Federer's feel and his athleticism and the otherworldly talent this guy possesses.
That's John Wertheim, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. Roger Federer meets Argentine Juan Martín Del Potro, 4 p.m. Eastern Time in the U.S. Open in Flushing Meadows. John, thank you.
Pleasure.